Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben. Today, my guest is Brendan McNamara. Brendan teaches religion at University College Cork, and is the author of this outstanding new monograph, The Reception of Abdu'l-Bahá in Britain, East Comes West, just published by Brill 2021. Brendan, congratulations on the book, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Crawford. Lovely to see you.
It's good to see you as well. No, it's great to see you. Listen, before we talk about the book, tell us a bit about yourself. You've been working on this subject, the formation, the expansion of the Baha'i faith for a long time. Tell us how you came to publish this book earlier this year.
Well, thanks, Crawford. Yeah, I have actually. I mean, in a sense too, I've kind of come to academic work quite late, but I've always had an interest in history and I've been, if you like, an amateur historian, so working away, and particularly around the history of the Baha'i Faith and its connection to Ireland. So I did edit a compilation of essays or a number of essays around the early links between the Baha'i Faith and Ireland about 10 years ago. But I always wondered about Abdu'l-Bahá's visits, which were a particular interest to the West, where between 1911 and 1913, which were a huge event within Baha'i history. But I wondered also, because it was such a public event and created such an interest on the part of vast numbers of people at the time, just even from press coverage of the day, I always wondered, well, what was it about Abdu'l-Bahá that people were interested in? So in other words, looking at it from the other side and having become involved in academic work a number of years ago and eventually getting to the stage where I did start a PhD, a little bit late, but better than late than never, I chose that subject, the reception of Abdu'l-Bahá in Britain, to try and get behind that. So who were all these high-profile people who welcomed Abdu'l-Bahá into discussion around religion just in the early years of the 20th century? What was their agenda? What was the nature of their interest in this, if you like, Eastern religious figure who had come out of a period of most of his life being in prison, in fact, or being in prison and in exile? And so in a sense, the work then developed in my mind around what would it be like not to do a book about Abdu'l-Bahá per se, but about that reception, those individuals who I found were quite extraordinary, interesting, fascinating people in their own right and had multiple ideas around what was happening with respect to religion in their own time for various different reasons. And so in a way, it was kind of recovering that history. And I think what you'll find is that history is is looked at in a particular way. That's what I found, what I would contend, and that may be not the full picture. So I wasn't necessarily trying to recover everything the way it actually was, but to somehow throw some light on some obscure aspects of that period, which would be significant and would be significant for us in the here and now. So I've worked on that. I've worked also on issues of identity, looking at figures in Irish history who were involved in the empire, in the age of empire, is very topical at the moment. And one of the projects I'm interested in doing now is around that as well. People from Ireland who fetched up in Iran in the early days of the Baha'i Faith, for example, who a doctor who was half Irish from Kilkenny, wife of the British minister to the Shah in 1852, around the very tumultuous days of the birth of the Baha'i Faith in Iran, and how they, in service to the empire and being from Catholic backgrounds, how they negotiated all those different challenges around identity, and were witness to some very extraordinary happenings and left records of them, so which was, of course, quite interesting. So I've published on that as well. So, yeah, this was a labour of interest, but it was also, I was very conscious that coming from my own Baha'i background, that I was going to be looking around the corner at it to some extent, around areas that haven't been looked at before. And I was very grateful then, having come through the Study of Religions department in UCC and having studied under some wonderful people, Professor Brian Bocking, Oliver Sharbrot, that really I was training to do this piece of work and hopefully other pieces of work on into the future.
Great. Oh, thanks, Brendan. That's really helpful just to contextualise the book that we're talking about today, The Reception of Abdu'l-Bahá in Britain. As I say, just published by Brill, 2021. You've mentioned there the Baha'i Faith and obviously Abdu'l-Bahá as well. Could you tell us really, really quickly, for any listeners who aren't familiar with that tradition, how it emerged, when it emerged, where it emerged, maybe some of the principal themes in Baha'i teaching that Abdu'l-Bahá then was able to take forward?
Well, it emerged in Iran in the mid-1800s. Abdu'l-Bahá is actually the son of the founder of the Baha'i Faith. And there are two principal figures in Baha'i history, founding figures, the Bab and Baha'u'llah, both of whom are mentioned in the book, just to give background, Crawford. And they emerged in a Shia context, in a Shia milieu. And the idea was that their teaching was the founding theme of their new religion was that they really were fulfilling prophecies within Shia tradition, that there would be a new messenger or prophet of God would come, and that it would bring new teachings for humanity in this particular day. So what happened as an outcome of that is that, for a variety of different reasons and fascinating reasons, it caused a tremendous tumult, a tremendous air of interest on the part of many, many thousands of people from all different sections and segments of society, such that the clerical and civil authorities arose to try and extirpate this new religion. And as a result, many thousands of people were killed. The Bab himself, the first founding figure, was executed. But Baha'u'llah, because of his family background, perhaps, which was from a very influential family with very strong royal connections, rather than being executed, he was exiled. And so that begins the story of Abdu'l-Bahá, because Abdu'l-Bahá, as a child, with his father, was sent out of their home country from place to place until eventually in distant part of the Ottoman Empire, which was Syria and Palestine, they were consigned to the prison city of Akka. And that was their final destination, to try and remove them from any center of influence. And so Abdu'l-Bahá, Baha'u'llah, of course, lived and passed away in 1892 during that period. And Abdu'l-Bahá, for another number of years, was still consigned, not necessarily always within a prison cell, but under house arrest. Sometimes those restrictions were eased, but certainly always within the city of Akka, until he was in his late 60s. So the major themes of the Baha'i Faith are around the oneness of God and the oneness of religion, And so the teachings teach that there is a connection between all the religions, in that they come from one divine source, and that this is the latest emanation of God's will to humanity. Socially, it has aspects that meet the needs socially, but spiritually, it reiterates and amplifies spiritual themes that exist in all the major religions. That would have been quite challenging, of course, at the time within an Islamic milieu, particularly where that is regarded as being the last chapter in the scheme of divine revelation. And explains some of the pretty awful treatment that was meted out to people who accepted this new faith. So the life then of Abdu'l-Bahá in the prison city of Aqqa is one of support, and very much serving the needs of this newborn faith, the center of which is his father. During these times of exiles from one place to place, it so happens then, of course, that the seed of this new faith is moving further and further away from its country of origination. And small communities of Baha'is are developing in all those eastern countries that surround Iran, Iraq, and then, of course, into Syria and Palestine, which, of course, I should say, has now become modern day Israel, which is quite an interesting fact that the world center of the Baha'i faith, the center of it spiritually and administratively, surrounding the resting place, the tomb of Baha'u'llah, and administrative center close by, is all in modern Israel. So Abdu'l-Bahá then finally, in his middle to late 60s, with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan, and the Young Turk Revolution, was finally allowed, along with many other religious and political prisoners, finally to be free. But at that stage, even during those years, as I mentioned, there was an interest that developed in countries close by, but they also, that word spread far and wide. And sometimes it came, actually, interestingly enough, from missionaries returning to the West, for want of a better word, who would bring word, or newspaper reports, or diplomats. For example, I think I mentioned the wife of the British minister in Tehran at the time of the Bab was Lady Sheel, who was actually a Wolf from, her name was Wolf, maiden name Wolf from Ennis. And she wrote a very influential travelogue in 1856, having been in Tehran around the time of the Babi upheavals, called Glimpses of Life and Manners in Persia, in which she details quite a number of the events that take place, that she kind of gathered information about from her time in the British mission there. So word was spreading, and interestingly enough, even in the newspapers in Ireland, the north and south local newspapers had syndicated reports of these happenings. So it was that a number of sympathizers, even before Abdu'l-Bahá's release from prison, were able to travel from the United States, from the United Kingdom. There's a very famous group of people under Mrs. Hearst, who was the wife of the newspaper mogul, who traveled in the early 1900s, before Abdu'l-Bahá was released in 1909 and 1908, that they were able to visit with Abdu'l-Bahá. Was difficult, there were restrictions, but they were still able to see him in his home. And so in that way, word was coming out of this very extraordinary, charismatic figure who was in prison for practically most of his life. And Abdu'l-Bahá had taken over, which I should have said, on his father's passing, as head of the Baha'i religion. He was the head of the religion after his father's passing, by dint of his father's appointing him as such in his will and testament. So Abdu'l-Bahá was a known figure then, certainly in the Levant, and also becoming more known otherwise.
So the seeds, if you like, of the Baha'i faith then were beginning to spread in the 1890s, early 1900s. And obviously, as you mentioned, there are some very significant society figures who take an interest in Abdu'l-Bahá, his situation, his teachings, and so on. And one of the things you show us, Brendan, in the book is that when these ideas eventually begin to migrate to England, that they take root in quite a surprising milieu, perhaps, a milieu that might be characterised by obviously an interest in Eastern religion, but also an interest in Celticism and spiritualism. What's going on when people with those kinds of interests take an interest in Abdu'l-Bahá?
It's quite fascinating, isn't it, Crawford? And it was quite fascinating to me to see. I remember speaking about Abdu'l-Bahá at a summer school once, and talking about this marvelous figure, R.J. Campbell, who was a Congregationalist minister in London at the time, probably the most renowned religious figure of his era in terms of how well known he was, very charismatic, known as being the arbiter of a new reformation, some people thought, within liberal Protestantism. And somebody said, when I mentioned his name, they said, well, why was he interested in Abdu'l-Bahá? Because he became very interested in Abdu'l-Bahá. He and a number of others, Canon Wilberforce, who was really a scion of the Anglican Church, one of the, his background, his grandfather had been the abolitionist. He was the Archdeacon of Westminster, chaplain to the Parliament, to the Parliament in Westminster. And he also became quite interested. And then you have other people, Celticists, spiritualists, Wesley Tudor Pole, who theosophists, of course. So I think what it betokens is, and when we see what happens, is that there is a tremendous interest in religious inquiry. And that, if you like, looking at it from the perspective of what is normally considered the Victorian crisis of faith, which has been problematized by scholars now, it wasn't a matter of just people losing their religion as a factor of a new interest in science and development and enlightenment thinking and so forth. There was also a tremendous evangelical movement at that time, and you probably know more about this than I do, certainly, Crawford. And there was a certain response to that. And one of those responses was within, it was like a religious response or a Protestant response, was to look for ideas outside. I know one of the commentators of that time, when they look at what was a time of great perturbation for Protestantism within the British experience, when they look at that time, they say there was no need to look outside Christianity to answer or to understand what that was all about. But in fact, looking back at that period now, what we can see is, in fact, that people began to really look outside. There was a tremendous universalist idea that religions were connected to each other, albeit people were looking through a Christian lens or filter. They still believed very deeply in the principles of Christianity. They were still willing to think that there wasn't just one religion in the world, that many religions had something that they needed to connect with. And I think why they were interested is an interesting question. I think perhaps they also thought that if they could find some kind of spiritual germ of inspiration, that it would somehow also be a help to renew what had become, in their estimation, somewhat moribund, that was trying to respond to this evangelical movement, great movement in Britain at the time. And that brought together a quite extraordinary, diverse range of people who were beginning to inquire about religions outside of Christianity. And so I think Gives calls it journeying outside of traditional Christianity. So they were journeying. They weren't necessarily going to leave, most of them. Some of them did, but they were journeying, and they became interested in Buddhism. There's a great movement and interest in Buddhism at the time. If we talk about the late 1800s, early 1900s, there's an interest in, and then Theosophy and Baha'i and all kinds of, and Celticism and Tudor Pole, and Celticism is very interesting from in this context. And I think that maybe you're looking at then also what wasn't looked at in great detail, I thought, when I came to write the book, was that this actually resulted in the visits to Britain of these very interesting religious figures, real icons, like Vivekananda, who was the Vedantist Hindu figure, like Dharmapala, a great Buddhist modernist, Inayat Khan, who was also very influential, maybe not known, founder of Western Sufism, and then Abdul Baha. And I thought, well, there's a kind of a genre there, of there's something happening here. And a lot of the people who were interested in Abdul Baha were also interested in Vivekananda slightly earlier, were also interested in Dharmapala, were also interested in Theosophy. Theosophy also seemed to be one of those connectors between people like Tudor Pole, the Celticist, and Wilberforce, the Anglican Archdeacon, and R.J. Campbell, the Congregationalist minister whom I mentioned earlier on. And then also, and it did seem to be, and you mentioned earlier that people in high society, it did seem to be people in high society, maybe people who had more time to think about these things, who were interested in these religions. So you have figures in the establishment, Lady Blomfield, actually was Irish, also an Irish woman who married into an establishment family in Britain, and others, Sister Nivedita, who was from Armagh, who became Vivekananda's star believer and supporter in Britain, and later in India, and extraordinary figures like this. And I could see that there was a kind of a web of connection between them. There was a kind of a field of religious inquiry. I think I began to think about it in terms of this field that had connections between the center and the edge. And, you know, there was movement between one area and the other in terms of influence and so forth. And it created a great energy that somehow later on was recorded, was not captured in the recording of it. And that comes then to later on in trying to think about, well, why, if that was so such an exciting milieu, and if that was so important, and like if when Abdul Baha came to Britain, he was already a known figure, that people had known about the Bab, that people like E.G. Brown, who had spent most of their academic career, a lot of their academic career, bringing the figure of the Bab to an English reading audience, that you know, that why isn't that remembered? You know, we think of the amount of coverage that it attracted at the time, or interest that it attracted at the time. Mm. So Celticism is a very interesting one, because there is that connection between people like Wesley Tudor Pole, and I mentioned and go through this in the book, the Glastonbury Cup, and his idea of creating an indigenous Christian identity, or again, a kind of a renewal, a Christian renewal around Glastonbury, around sacred landscape of Glastonbury, finding this cup, which had actually been placed there, but still they believed had been at one time in the possession of Jesus, or certainly around at that time. And had been at one time, though not the Holy Grail, he said. And there's this fascinating story about how he tries to track down the provenance of that cup, trying to, again, ignite this renewal of Christianity, not just in England, but also in Scotland and in Ireland, which brings him to Constantinople, because he feels that there is documentation to be found. And it's a quest of extraordinary proportions, and it's wild in a way. He gets into all kinds of trouble. He's arrested. But what happens there is that it's the first time that he comes in contact with Baha'is and with the idea that there is this figure who has been imprisoned for most of his life in nearby Akka, and who has this influence, albeit being a prisoner, he has this influence and popularity. And he became enchanted with the idea and began to investigate it. Came back to Britain after one of these quest adventures, thinking that he probably was the person who knew about the Baha'i figure, Abdul Baha, and found that there were actually others. And amongst those others were people who were also interested in this Glastonbury Cup, so there's all these kind of connections.
So, I mean, your book describes really vividly, Brendan, both the very personal quest of someone like Tudor Pole, but also Abdul Baha's visits, for example, to R.J. Campbell's church, where there are, I think you tell us, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people regularly crowding out, and he has the opportunity to address a vast audience in the centre of London, in the City Temple. And I think you also tell us that Campbell presents Abdu'l-Bahá as someone who is essentially preaching the same thing, the same message. So what does that tell us about the nature of liberal Protestantism, or that phase of liberal Protestantism? Often when we read the intellectual history of this period, Protestant liberals are presented as being very rational, very hard-edged, in contrast to the theosophists and the spiritualists and the Celticists of this world. And yet Abdu'l-Bahá speaks to them all. Mm. How do you explain that?
That's quite a fascinating question, Crawford. I think also, it's a factor of how this history is captured, and it's probably a later point in the book to see why the story of these figures and their interests is not fully drawn. And it's some part of they have a part in that themselves, in the way that they later on recall their history, or they may be like Wilberforce in the war comes and he dies during the war and never really probably has a chance to reflect what Campbell does, because he lives quite a lot longer. But for a variety of reasons, some of it to do with themselves, that history is not very well drawn, and anything before the war is kind of looked at as being just a little bit, idiosyncratic, a little bit off the wall. I think even one of well-known historian Barbara Chipman talks about that period being effete. So in a way they're blamed also for causing everybody to get involved in this war and not to be forgiven. But the understanding of that period before the war is not very good. And that was one of the things that I wanted to do in the book, was to recover the story of these wonderful individuals and how they did strike out to experiment and explore religious ideas and have a discussion which was vibrant around religion in a way that really didn't come about again until the 1960s with the rise of the counterculture, if you like. And maybe that's a bit fanciful, but I think that's probably not a bad comparison. You don't find these things easily. I couldn't find those things easily as to why these people were interested until I began to read the newspapers of the time, and in particular the Christian Commonwealth newspaper, which was the vehicle of R.J. Campbell and Congregational Christianity. Now, you mentioned about the 7,000. I think we can't get an idea about how popular this man actually was. There were rosaries made. Coming from a Catholic background myself, I don't know what Protestants you have find use in rosaries, but it is recounted that rosaries were made from his sermons, and you could write in and get a picture of him and a calendar and all kinds of, there was all kinds of personal memorabilia around him. He was an extraordinary guy, but of course he inspired tremendous affection. And also from hardline members of the establishment, the opposite as well. He was a very controversial figure in that sense, but hugely popular. And maybe that's one of the reasons why he did attract such a vehement response from some of the people in the Anglican Church, because he was so popular. And of course, that wasn't necessarily always the case with clergymen. But he was quite an extraordinary figure, and he was very interested in. For example, not only did he have Abdu'l-Bahá come along and speak at his church in one of those Sunday sermons, I think it was, just after Abdu'l-Bahá had arrived in London for the first time in September 1911, Campbell and the editor of that newspaper, a man called Dawson, visited him, and they covered his arrival. There was a big spread about him being in the newspaper. In fact, they covered every one of his appointments or appearances in Britain throughout his visit. But they also asked him to come. Campbell asked him to come to the City Temple on Holborn Aqueduct to speak. And there was a great closeness of interest on Campbell's behalf. There's no doubt about it. And But he also had Annie Besant come and talk about theosophy. He had C.K. Chesterton come, and you know, so there was all kinds of people that he was interested in having. But you don't get that very much in his writings or in writings of the time. But you do get it in the Christian Commonwealth. You get the interest, his interests expressed in articles about Buddhism and Hinduism and about Vedantism and all kinds of interesting ideas. You have people like Tudor Pole writing in the Christian Commonwealth. You have people like T.K. Cheney, who was the Oriel Professor of Christianity. Is that
interpretation
right?
Of Holy Scripture, wasn't it? Yeah.
Interpretation of Christianity. Thanks, yeah. Crawford, at Oxford. And you have him editing, being a part of the editorial board of that newspaper. It really is an extraordinary expression, I think, of maybe a response to their time, maybe a zeitgeist of now beginning to find out about new religions for the first time. You know, like you have material appearing in English in the English language for the first time around different religions. You have these figures who are known, who actually have come to Britain and who are quite familiar to many. You have, I suppose, if you could call it a religious literacy that didn't exist afterwards, and wasn't reflected back on the period. It was almost like those middle years after the war, and those difficult times. And if you think of it in Irish terms, after independence and the whole construction of what it meant to be this side of the border, anyway, Crawford, about it, what it meant to be Irish. And what that actually left out, and what it could only include. And one of the things about the identity generally of people around those middle centuries after the First World War was that it lost that element of religious literacy, which seemed to take the air seemed to be taken out of this religious field of inquiry with the onset of the First World War.
So your book tells us, Brendan, there was two visits that Abdu'l-Bahá yes. made to Britain, wasn't there? The first one takes place very much in with that air of celebrity about it. The second one's maybe a little bit different. Some of his supporters, Campbell, Wilberforce, have backed away a little bit. And of course, Campbell won't just back away. He will eventually come to recognise this as a very grievous mistake. And you mentioned the war. Is it the war? And I think you mentioned earlier on as well that Wilberforce, for example, is promoting participation in the war. Tudor Pole himself signs up, doesn't he, and serves within the army. Is it the war that takes the steam out of this movement, or is something else at play?
Well, again, I think that probably could do with even more examination, Crawford. What I tended to think, having looked at it, was that the war is that great big climacteric, which kind of collapses a particular worldview, and it brings home something like you mentioned Wilberforce. Wilberforce was sometimes would step back and would sometimes come forward, as with the Glastonbury Cup, as with Abdu'l-Bahá. It didn't betoken that he lost personal interest, but he was sometimes the subject of mild reproval from the authorities, and I suppose looking to the positions that he occupied, he probably was wise to be careful at times. And also maybe he suffered for his interests because, you know, he was never made a bishop, and there was all kinds of other things that happened. Even when his obituary is written, it's not very complimentary, shall we say, of him. So he does step back a little bit during the second visit, I think particularly because of something that happened in the United States. So Abdu'l-Bahá comes to Britain, and then he goes back to the Levant, and then goes to the United States, and on his way back stops in Britain and in France and other countries on the way. That's the second visit. So during the second visit, there is a year between. Yes, things have happened. Abdu'l-Bahá has been in the United States, and there's been a kind of a little bit of a frisson in that he has been invited to speak at the Episcopalian Church in New York, and sits on the was invited to sit on the bishop's chair, and this is because the minister there, like Wilberforce, was quite interested in what he had to say, and this makes its way back by dint of newspaper reports that are contained in the Church Times, and it's like a little bit of a reproval to Wilberforce, but it certainly seems to soften his interest. But what happens when the war comes is of a different order, I think, in that. The war comes, his nephew and his son, is it? Yeah, are all involved off to the front. And it becomes much more personal. And there is a crisis within Christianities then, isn't there? There's a crisis of values, I think, is the way I put it in the book, where now you're fighting your friendly, formerly friendly German Christian people, and it's Christian against Christian. Which brings in kind of really must have been so difficult when they were thinking of Christianity moving out to and in a sense into this bright new world of other religions and maybe even being the kind of overshadowing or overarching religion or religious sensibility that would in somehow take them all in, and now you have this happening, and it's frightfully. It's traumatizing, and so you have Wilberforce actually saying, which is something that seems so out of character, in a set piece sermon he gives in Westminster Abbey with very dignitaries from the government and so on in present and officers and soldiers ready to go off, that it's really doing the will of God to kill Germans basically, which is something that seems to be. Completely opposite to what he would have felt. Campbell's is a slightly different, I suppose, then you look at what has happened individually with them as well. There is this great trauma, but it's experienced, of course, individually. For Campbell, who always had that kind of a certain fragility of temperament, and there was always this kind of mystery illnesses that he would suffer from. Before the onset of war, in fact, he did seem to suffer some kind of a breakdown, and he's withdrawn from public life. So during the second visit, even though he invites Abdu'l-Bahá to his home and invites seminarians to come and meet Abdu'l-Bahá, and there is a very convivial discussion and interplay between them and a lot of affection, it would seem to be obvious. Campbell at that stage has very much retired from public life, and his breakdown becomes complete with the onset of war, and he really resiles from all previous positions, withdraws from Congregationalism and takes Anglican orders, and then enters into a life of quietism, really, until his passing in 1956. So he was around for quite a long time, but never afterwards craved the public eye, and in fact went to such lengths that he writes in his autobiography, which is 1916, quite early, and really forswears any interest in any of the in any of the other religions, it seems to kind of, as you say, well, this was all a mistake. But other commentators have said that it wasn't necessarily the product of a lucid mind. I think one of them says. But all those years afterwards, he doesn't comment on it, and at the end. He leaves instructions that all his papers should be destroyed, which they were, unfortunately. So they're on his passing. So and then Tudor Pole. So I go into these figures, I suppose, to exemplify the fact that the crisis was felt generally, the crisis of values, but experienced individually. Tudor Pole is kind of anti-war, but still feels this sense of duty, and is very interested very interested in spiritual experiences and spiritualism and Celticism. As I mentioned, this idea of an indigenous Christianity growing up around sacred landscape in Glastonbury. But he also got the sense of the movement of souls from here to what he called au-delà, the next level, and how he could facilitate that. And he does a very interesting thing. He enlists as a soldier, even though because of his status and the work he did, he was in a protected employment. He didn't have to go, but he also could have gone in as an officer. And he lives and as an enlisted soldier, and is for those first number of months the experience of being there until eventually they persuade him to take a commission. And he finds himself in the wounded and then transferred to the intelligence wing in Egypt, where in a very interesting serendipity, he also is involved in Abdu'l-Bahá's protection around the coming to the conclusion of the First World War, when Abdu'l-Bahá back now in Palestine and in Israel, present day Israel, is under threat as the war is coming to an end from the Mufti of Jerusalem, who was kind of out to again it's a religious persecution thing, and Tudor Pole is influential in garnering support amongst, you know, high profile people back in the UK, that when Allenby is going in to take Palestine, that they actually protect the position of Abdu'l-Bahá. That's what actually happens. You know, so an interesting come around. So a long winded answer to your question. I'm sorry, Rob.
Not at all, Brendan. It's always a real pleasure.
Interesting thing that when you read the pages of the Christian Commonwealth and you realise just how diverse were the interests of these people, and how they were connected to each other, and how their kind of interests intersected like a web, a connection, that it really, I think the war did explode it in a great way. I'm sure there might have been other factors that I'm not aware of.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating conclusion to a fascinating book, Brendan, and really grateful for you for writing it and for coming on to the show to talk about it today. Can we ask you what you're working on next?
Thank you, Robert. I'm sorry, I didn't realise it was coming to an end. I talked too much. I know you said we should talk, but I'm actually very interested in that whole religious environment in Ireland prior to independence. And I became interested in this graduate of NUI Galway called James O'Keneely, who went out as a member of the Indian Civil Service and became a high-ranking judge of the High Court and a scholar of Islam. And so I'm interested in this whole juxtaposition of identity and empire, and also then the validity of the work that is done in these circumstances, you know, because these are Orientalists and that whole dimension. And he was translating texts around Wahhabism. And they were, of course, for the purpose of protecting the powers that be against what they perceived to be a rising Islamist movement connected to Wahhabism in Arabia that had come out of that. So this is the late 1800s, late 1850s and 60s. So I've become interested in that. I was looking at something that Brian Bocking and Christopher Shackle wrote around Max Arthur McAuliffe, who you may know is this Irish guy who also went out to be part of the Indian Civil Service and ended up as a scholar of Sikhism and a translator of the sacred texts of the Sikhs, and who's very highly regarded. And when he was writing about him in one of the Irish Academic Study of Religion journal articles, he talks about the fact that in Ireland in the 1900s there was more known about religion in the East than there was in the year 2000. And of course, one of the factors of that is the movement between places like India and Ireland and the involvement in empire at all different levels, from the highest level to the lowest level. But there was also then this milieu that I just spoke about or that I cover in the book, which did also affected Ireland, you know, because Abdu'l-Bahá is also appearing in the newspapers in Ireland. Going back even further, the predicament of the Babis and their persecution is appearing in the Roscommon Chronicle and in the, you know, there's advertisements for talks about Abdu'l-Bahá in the Unitarian Church and, you know, in the Ballymena Observer. And so not that everybody's reading newspapers, but there is this kind of religious literacy. And Brian Bocking and Christopher Shackle mentioned people like Max Arthur McAuliffe and Sister Nivedita, and you know you have other people, Mir Urad Ali, who was the great Islamic scholar teaching at Trinity in those times. A little bit later on, the Baha'i writer George Townsend, people who actually stayed here as well as people who went out. And of course, Udamaloka, scholars have just written this wonderful book. Brian and a couple of others have written this wonderful book about the Irish Buddhist monk in Burma around this time. So what I'm, long story short, Crawford, I'm interested in that period and in those figures who are generating knowledge and how we can place that knowledge, where we can place it. I think it's a very contemporary issue, maybe even a contentious issue now, where we are in this side of the country about Ireland's involvement in empire, but also just all celebrating the fact that there is some very interesting things. Because, I mean, O'Keneely, the person I mentioned, of course, is not black and white. He's not just an Orientalist. He's not just trying to stave off this movement of Wahhabism. He's also trying to promote education. He's also involved in translating other things around Islam. He's become a kind of a lover of, and that's quite complicated then. Yeah, that's quite complicated.
Well, Brendan, that sounds fascinating. That sounds like a great project, and hopefully we'll have you back to talk about it sometime. That would be great.
Thanks very much, Crawford. Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks for your time today, and thanks for writing this book, The Reception of Abdu'l-Bahá in Britain, East Comes West, published by Brill 2021. Thanks for your time and take care.
Thank you so much, Crawford, and great to see you. Thank you so much.
And thanks to everyone else for listening in today as well. I'll see you next time on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.